This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode number 60, for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. Welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host, Podcast Steve on Twitter. This program is about communications, public relations, and journalism, and we speak with interesting personalities in those fields. In this program, we'll have two conversations. First, we'll talk with Rob Biesenbach. He's a corporate communications expert and professional speaker who will be appearing for the IABC Philadelphia chapter this week in King of Prussia. And then we'll chat with Gary Frisch of Voorhees, New Jersey, who's a public relations practitioner with his own public relations firm, Swordfish Communications. Our first guest on the podcast is Rob Biesenbach. Rob's a corporate communications expert, author, actor, and public speaker, and he's fighting to wipe out dull, ordinary communications in our time. Combining insights from 25 years in business with performance experience gained as a Second City-trained actor, Rob helps people communicate more successfully in the workplace, the marketplace, and in their everyday lives. He's going to be appearing in the Philadelphia area this week on November 4th. He will make a presentation to the Philadelphia chapter of the International Association of Business Communicators. That'll be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Crown Plaza Hotel in King of Prussia. You can get more information and you can still register to attend the IABC Philadelphia event with Rob Biesenbach by going to iabcphiladelphia.org. On any given day, Rob may be helping a corporate client develop a long-range employee engagement strategy, writing a speech for an executive, delivering a presentation to a group of business people, or acting in a commercial. His business background includes 15 years of independent corporate communications PR practice, in which he counsels a range of clients, from Fortune 500 companies to startups. And before that, he was a vice president at Ogilvy Public Relations Worldwide and press secretary to the Ohio Attorney General, and also worked as communications director at a Washington, D.C. association. Rob, welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
So, Rob, why is it that business professionals need to think about the tips they can get from actors on the stage and on the movie screen?
Well, this idea occurred to me a few years ago. I had pursued a conventional career in business doing corporate communications and PR for 30 years. But about a dozen years ago, I started acting. And I thought that these were two separate worlds, the acting and the business. But the more I performed and studied, the more I realized that, hey, we're doing the same thing here on stage that I'm doing with my clients. I'm reaching out to an audience. I'm communicating creatively and visually. I'm telling stories. So all of these lessons I found apply very much to the business world.
So you say the key is to treat every communication like a performance. How do you do that? How do you actually implement that?
Well, you think first and foremost about your audience, and I think too often we think about ourselves. This is what I want to say. This is what people need to know. But if you start it first from an audience perspective, thinking about their wants and needs and desires, then that is your first step of getting off on the right foot.
So how do you get someone started thinking like an actor?
Well, in terms of thinking about the audience, you think about who they are, what do they want, what are their needs, what is their mood, and their doubts and fears and misperceptions. But that's really the beginning. There's a whole bunch of areas where they need to attend to, from the way they carry themselves physically, to the tone of voice, to the way they construct their message, the way they tell stories. It's tons and tons of important lessons.
Now, you'll be speaking to the Philadelphia chapter of the International Association of Business Communicators on Wednesday, November 4th. What are some of the tips that you're going to focus on giving them?
I'm going to take techniques from the world of acting to help them, not only help them in their own business, help them if they have clients, but also help them in their own personal marketing. Because I find even corporate communications, marketers, and PR people, we're not the best at doing our own PR. So how to package a message into a narrative, how to humanize yourself, how to take advantage of emotion, which is a powerful, powerful way to persuade an audience, how to listen It's just really, really important that not many people are really good listeners.
Are there any examples of people who do what you describe really, really well?
Well, I guess the classic example is one that everybody points to is Steve Jobs. He was a master showman. But it's interesting, in spite of the fact that, you know, he would come out and do these presentations with drama and intrigue, and he would use visuals like an actor might use props. He would tell stories. He would keep the audience on the edge of their seats. It's funny how so many people don't really, they admire him, just like they might admire TED talkers, but they're not so good at implementing the actual lessons. There's a disconnect there. It's odd to me.
How do you get past it? How do you get people to be more effective at that?
I think first making them realize, they think, oh, well, TED talkers, they prepare for dozens of hours, or they're professional speakers, or they have a really inspiring story about curing cancer or something. My stuff is too boring. I don't have time. I think you can get past those hurdles. I believe that comparing yourself to, say, Steve Jobs or a TED talker is kind of self-defeating. It's not like somebody sees a professional golfer on TV and thinks they're going to go out and just golf like that this weekend. But if you start with some simple steps, tell more stories, be more visual, connect emotionally, analyze your audience, I think you can take your communications a lot farther than you might think you would be able to.
So let me ask you about every corporate communications person's nemesis, PowerPoint. How do you feel about people using PowerPoint in their talks?
Well, PowerPoint is a tool that could be used for good and for evil. You know, people ask me sometimes, and I've heard this, they ask other speakers, like, oh, what is that program you use? It's just PowerPoint or the Mac equivalent of Keynote. But what I do is my template is just a blank screen, and I load it up with photos and very little text. You don't need special templates or, you know, crazy dissolves and transitions. You just need evocative images that excite your audience and underscore your message, and a few words to reinforce the points you're making.
How do we get companies and their executives to regard effective speaking as a valuable business tool? Because in a lot of companies, it doesn't seem like they put a lot of emphasis on people preparing and rehearsing. They expect them to drone on and not be terribly exciting.
Yeah, that's a big barrier I see with some of my bigger clients. It's built into their culture, this PowerPoint thing. They have these legacy decks, and they share the same slides with these giant graphics representing, you know, flow charts and vision statements. And they're used to sending the deck in advance so people can read it, and then they come to the presentation, and you're regurgitating everything they supposedly just read. So for me, fundamentally, it's about a culture change, of really changing people's attitudes about what a presentation is. And that sounds big and intimidating, but I think if you can start with a couple of breakout stars, people who adapt these lessons, and they start to get noticed within the company, and people start saying, wow, the CEO really liked that presentation. How do I get one like that? How do I stand out like he did?
So what are some of the really satisfying successes you've had where, you know, you had clients or students who actually said, you know, you saw the light bulb go on that they got it, what you were trying to get them to do?
Yeah, sometimes I worked with some engineers and technical people. And again, there's a feeling on their part that, well, I don't want to dumb my content down too much. I have to be, I'm just talking to a sophisticated crowd. And I always say, you don't have to dumb down the content, but you can make it visual. You can tell stories. And I was working with this one young engineer, and over the course of a day, where he started was just a very technical standpoint of, you know, all the usual speaking mistakes. But over time and practice and discussion, he started to tell his story with passion and intensity. And he was able to let go of the PowerPoint and really flourish. I mean, people want to have a relationship with the person who's speaking. They came to see a person, not to read a screen.
So you've been at this for a couple of decades or more. What are some of the changes you've seen in professional communications that are for the better? And maybe what are some of the changes you've seen that are not so good?
You know, it's interesting. If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I mean, I would tell anybody, what's the most important skill in communications? I would have said writing. And these days I say the ability to present, because it just comes up in so many ways. Pitching new business, trying to get approval for a budget. And I really consider everything a presentation. Interviewing for a job, holding a constructive meeting. So for me, I think that's been one of the biggest changes with the rise of TED Talks, with decreasing attention spans. Suddenly, we're supposed to be not just passing along information, but we're supposed to be motivating people. We're supposed to be brief. We're supposed to have drama and a little bit of humor. So the bar has never really been higher for people who want to communicate in business.
What about social media and the role that it plays in getting people out there and extending their so-called brand?
I think social media is wonderful. I think it's the best news ever for introverts. A lot of people I work with are natural introverts. And the ability to start up, to sort of warm up to your network online, which a lot of people find much more comfortable, I think it's just been a boon to a lot of people. And that way, like if you're going to a meeting or a conference, you can already strike up a relationship with people in advance, and it won't be like walking into a room full of strangers. And it just allows you the opportunity to reach out to almost anybody. And if you don't do it obnoxiously, you can develop a relationship with them. It's amazing.
You have a couple of books out on the topic. You have a book called Act Like You Mean Business, and you have one called 11 Deadly Presentation Sins. What are some of the sins that people need to avoid?
Many.
Without giving away the content of the book, because I get it, you know, we want to get you to sell more books, obviously.
Oh, no, it's no problem. On my website, people can walk through all 11 sins. People ask me, well, can you boil it down to 3 or 4? And I think I can do about 5, but lack of storytelling, stories rule. People want to hear stories. They don't want a data dump. Lack of emotion. People want to see who you really are. They want to see your passion and enthusiasm for the subject. We talked about dull, ugly, text-heavy slides. People didn't come to read. They came to see you speak. And I would say opening strong and closing strong. Those are the first and last impressions are so important. And so many people just open a presentation by saying, oh, I'm so-and-so, and these are my credentials, and this is what I'm going to talk about today. But if you can start strong with a story or a startling statistic or a bold claim, you're going to get people engaged much more quickly.
So what would be your strong finish story?
My strong finish story. You mean a story that I would tell or a story about a strong finish?
Well, a story that you would tell.
Well, it's interesting. When I do my 11 Deadly Presentation Sins presentation, I start with a story about the worst presentation I ever saw in my life. The speaker made every mistake in the book, including starting off by trying to sell us his book. But it was terrible. He's droned on and on for an hour. He never engaged us in conversation. It was death by PowerPoint. And so then I go through the sins. And at the end, I come back to that story and said, by the way, that original speaker who put us through PowerPoint hell that day, he was a professional marketer. Somebody whose entire career is premised on reading an audience and delivering on their needs, and he utterly failed that day. So I say that first of all, it's very powerful to return to a story that you told in the beginning. It's a great callback. It closes things up nicely. But this story serves the purpose of telling people, don't feel so bad. Even the pros who should know better don't always do well.
Well, that's great. On that note, Rob, I thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing your presentation at the IABC Philadelphia meeting on November 4th in Philadelphia.
I can't wait to see everybody. Thank you, Steve.
Rob Biesenbach is the author of 11 Deadly Presentation Sins, and he'll be appearing at the IABC Philadelphia chapter on November 4th. You can get more information at iabcphiladelphia.org. We'll be right back. Gary Frisch, our next guest, founded Swordfish Communications in August 2007, and his focus is small and mid-sized businesses in the Philadelphia area and nationally. Gary began his career in public relations in 1989 with Panasonic Consumer Electronics Company, which is in Secaucus up in northern New Jersey. For 7 years, he wrote virtually every new product release for the Panasonic, Techniques, and Quasar brands, and he was involved in the debut of the Panasonic Palmcorder camcorder, as well as the digital audio tape and compact VHS media formats. While working for Panasonic, one magazine editor called him the man who makes things happen in Panasonic's PR department. Gary continued to work for Panasonic and other technology clients as an employee of New Directions Public Relations in Princeton. In 1997, he researched and wrote press materials and technical backgrounders that helped launch the first DVD players in the United States. Gary's been an adjunct instructor of public relations and public speaking at Temple University's Strategic and Organizational Communications Department, and he's a freelance writer contributing to such publications as Home Theater, Video Business, eBay Magazine, South Jersey Magazine, and he's published many op-ed pieces in newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Newark Star-Ledger, the Courier Post, and the Record of Northern New Jersey. Gary, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Talk a little bit about how you got into having your own agency, what kind of change it was for you to get into your own agency, and what you see in the future.
It was a long journey to get into my own agency. I've been wanting to do this for many, many years, going back to my very first public relations position with Panasonic up in North Jersey. And after working there for several years, a close friend of mine who handled the Panasonic account for a big New York PR agency went off on his own to start his company, and he basically took the Panasonic account with him through some maneuverings, and he brought me on board as his first employee. Now, they didn't know at the time, or they couldn't tell me at the time, he couldn't tell me at the time who I was going to be working for. So all I knew was I was being outsourced from Panasonic and going into the employ of somebody else, but they didn't tell me who. I had my suspicions, and I liked this guy very much, and I admired him for going off and starting his own agency, and it's something that I had been thinking about doing for a while, and I had actually spoken with him about doing for a while. It wasn't until several years and two other jobs after working for him that I finally was able to go ahead with my plan. And that entailed gathering a couple of clients on the sly while I was still full-time employed and getting the plan approved by my wife. And fortunately, at the time, she was earning a good salary in the health field. This is my ex-wife now. And I brought on three clients that combined totaled close to my monthly salary at my last paid job. And so at that point, I gave notice at my job, and I left there in an agency in Philadelphia in January of 2008, having incorporated my own business 4 months earlier. And that's how I started Swordfish Communications.
Now, did you always work in agency, or did you have any experience on the corporate side?
After Panasonic, I was just agency. I worked in-house in the communications department at Panasonic for almost 7 years.
How did it change the way you practice public relations to go out on your own? What was different about it from working for someone else's agency?
There's a learning curve for sure. In addition to agency work in general means you have to be kind of a generalist. You have to be open to all kinds of ideas and learning your client's business. But I had done that before at other agencies. Going off on my own, there's the added challenge of rainmaking and bringing in those clients, because like they say on Mad Men, I think it was, the day you gain a client is the day you start losing a client. Basically, after the first year or year and a half, none of those three original clients were still my clients for whatever reasons, not because they were unhappy with me, but they just went different ways or their budget wouldn't allow continuing PR. However, as a result, I had to keep, you know, hitting the pavement and finding new clients. And that was difficult because you also want to do the best work you can for the clients you have, and you have to straddle that line of, you know, marketing yourself and doing the actual work. I then was and still am a solopreneur, and so I do everything myself, and the bookkeeping and the billing and all that. So that's been the biggest difference.
For public relations people who are still currently working for other people, but thinking about becoming solopreneurs. What is the most surprising thing you found about going out on your own?
How liberating it is. How really liberating it is going out to events and representing yourself and representing your own business versus somebody else's company. And having the freedom to pick and choose what you do from a marketing standpoint, what you do from a networking standpoint, that was the biggest and most pleasant eye-opener for me.
And what are the challenges that you face as a solopreneur?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is receivables, getting paid by my clients. You know, any entrepreneur can relate to that, I'm sure. Especially since as a PR person, you're a people person. And my business is based on relationships and creating them and getting along with people, not just the media, but clients certainly. And when I have to at the same time go after them for a late payment, it feels a little bit awkward for me. It's something I've never quite gotten used to. You know, usually it's not a big deal, but I always feel funny when I have to go out to somebody who's very late in paying and say, hey, you know, here's a reminder, can you please pay me? I wish there was somebody else who could handle that, and then I can just completely disassociate myself with that and say, oh, that's just that's Betty's job. She's just doing her job.
Sort of like an enforcer.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you could, describe some of the kinds of clients you're working with.
Over the last couple of years, I've worked with a mattress manufacturer in San Francisco. That's a 100-plus-year-old, 115-year-old company that still manufactures mattresses by hand. I work with a convenience store franchise company based in Topeka, Kansas, called Street Corner, and they have stores mostly in shopping malls in 19 states across the country, some of which are in New Jersey. And they're expanding their offerings, and so I handle all their public relations. My most long-term client at this point is an industrial coatings company in the suburbs of Philadelphia that provide slip-proof, decorative, anti-graffiti coatings for any type of surfaces, floors, walls, highway, bridge abutments, sound barriers, that kind of thing. And beyond that, I do a lot of work with a lot of smaller businesses in the area. I work with financial services companies. I've done work with mortgage brokerage companies. I've worked with medical technology / online companies. And I work with professional services, dentist office, doctors, lawyers, and I work with nonprofits as well quite a bit.
Now, you grew up in the PR industry before the dawn of the social media era, as I did, but it's something that's had to become a part of your repertoire. What are the things that you're seeing in social media that are either that are positive and that are useful to you, and what are some of the things you're seeing that are kind of negative?
Well, let me start with the positives. It's another means of reaching out to reporters through social media instead of the traditional phone call or email even. A lot of them are very likely to pick up on a tweet directly to them rather than an email. And it's another way social media to cut out what we call the gatekeeper in public relations. You're familiar with that, obviously. I can get my clients' messages out directly to their audiences without having to be at the whim of a writer, an editor, a producer. And in some cases, depending on, you know, who you're hitting and what channel you're using and how many followers that you might have, you have potential to reach at least as many people as with a traditional media outlet. And that's a nice thing.
So what are some of the downsides?
The downsides aren't so much. Well, the downsides are certainly there's a learning curve, and there's so many different platforms out there. It's hard to become expert in all of them. It takes time. It's also a matter of clients wanting instant results from social media, and it just doesn't work that way. I'd say those are the two main negatives. From a personal standpoint, I think one of the negatives of social media is anybody can have their soapbox and go out there and say anything that they want unchecked, just like we can for my clients other individuals, customers, whatnot, can go out there and say what they want, you know, unfiltered, whether it's true or not. And sometimes, even if it's true, there's a lot of nasty stuff on social media. And it's very bothersome to me that people post things without doing due diligence, perhaps, and rumors get spread very easily.
There's a lot of misinformation. I mean, on Facebook recently, people are posting this reminder to turn the clocks back, and the date was wrong, you know, and just everybody's reposting it.
Yes, and like the we just had Back to the Future Day last week, October 21st, and for years that meme was going around with artificial dates thrown into that, saying it was, you know, the date predicted in Back to the Future, and now it really was the date, but those kind of things just really annoy me.
And you mentioned, you know, reaching reporters, and increasingly that's become a real challenge because the number of people working in journalism, at least on a print journalism product, has declined dramatically. There are less and less people to talk to. How does that change the way you're pitching stories to the news media?
The key is to find out who's working in that sector that you're trying to pitch to, whether they're writing for traditional media or increasingly online media. The web is such a wonderful, huge terrain, and it's just driven by content. And there's so much content, and every day I'm learning about another website that might pertain to a client that I hadn't known about before. You know, I see these in, you know, linked from other sources. I see them in Harrow feeds, help a reporter out. And so it's really a grand universe of media outlets that we can pitch. And it lets you sometimes pigeonhole your pitch a little bit more than you would if you were pitching a mainstream newspaper, because some of these online publications are so, you know, micro-targeted within a certain niche. For example, the coding, the industrial coatings industry. Yeah, there are trade publications out there, but there are a multitude of online, you know, blogs, perhaps, that are being read by potential customers and my client that I can go out to pitch.
How have you had to change the way you practice public relations as a sole practitioner? Is there some way that you differentiate yourself from the larger agencies?
Yeah, those are two questions. I've changed the way I practice in terms of electronic communications is king. Reporters don't really have the time or the interest in speaking with a lot of reporters, a lot of PR people on the phone, like in the past, you know, going back 10 years or more. I think they're most, and PR people are more comfortable these days with electronic communications via email and Twitter and social media. And as far as the second part of your question,
what do you do? You're a solo practitioner, a small firm. How do you position yourself to look and feel different to the clients that you're pitching, who are almost certainly getting pitched by other agencies and possibly even by bigger ones?
Right. I rely on my creativity and my out-of-the-box thinking. I come up with ideas that some of my clients might reject as being too far out of the box, but I'd rather be, you know, reprimanded for thinking too far outside the box than not thinking outside the box at all. All PR people can claim to be, you know, creative. I'm an exceptionally strong writer, so I try to find that hook right up front. I try to keep it brief. I try to just engage the journalist as best I can. From another standpoint, in terms of how I differentiate my company, I work with smaller clients quite frequently. That's under, you know, 50 or 100 employees. A lot of, you know, boutique smaller businesses, and there are very few agencies that will touch companies like that. And I know because I had a friend do a secret shopper survey among some agencies as if they had a one-time project, a press release they wanted written and distributed, and they came back with very surprising results. And so I'm not making it up when I say there are very few agencies that will go near a one-off project, for example, without charging an arm and a leg. However, Swordfish will.
What do you see as the future for either public relations or journalism? You can talk about either or both. You know, in the context that there are some pretty dramatic changes going on. Do you recommend that students look at the fields, and what's your advice?
I think the basic tenets of public relations are always going to be there. You have to be a strong writer, and that's going to become more and more important because, like we talked about before, the elimination of gatekeepers and going out there with your own content. Organizations are going to be producing more increasingly their own content as authoritative publications. It's not going to be a company newsletter. It's going to be a company magazine or company based television program or company based TV station even. And those are going to need content. And that's an opportunity for the company to go out with their messages to their audiences. However, they're going to be done in such a way to be as journalistic as possible, because I think consumers can see through advertising and even advertorials. So the stronger your skills are at writing compelling content that's not all about self-promotion, that's more geared towards the target audience, the consumer perhaps, the better off you're going to be, and the easier it's going to become to get those organizational messages out.
What are some of the key mistakes that PR people make when they pitch the media?
One is being too wordy and giving a whole history of your client in the pitch when journalists have very little time to read that pitch because they're besieged with emails and, in some cases, phone calls. You have to get right to the point and do it quickly. You can't be what a former editor of mine, when I did some freelance writing, called clearing your throat. You can't do the background up front and then get into your pitch. You have to just get to the pitch as quickly as possible. Also, and this is a more common mistake than you might think, people pitching things that certainly are not in the wheelhouse of the person they're pitching, which will be rejected and ignored, but may also annoy the writer if you do it too often, because it shows you haven't done your research and don't know what that writer writes about. But also pitching things that are exploitative, perhaps. There's a tactic that I like to use from time to time called newsjacking, jumping on something that's going on in the media and instantly going out with a pitch related to that. But if you're newsjacking bad news or newsjacking something tragic, you have to be very careful. And a lot of there have been a lot of blogs based on very bad or very poorly timed or very tasteless pitches that have gone out.
And one of the things that I see a lot of is PR people who are kind of being pushed by the clients to constantly check back with journalists to find out, A, if they're going to use this story. Well, they start with, did you get the press release? And then if you did get it, are you going to use it? And then when are you going to use it? And they tend to make those calls pretty regularly.
And sometimes added to that, can you send me a copy when it appears?
What do people need to think about in terms of?
Well, again,
let's say managing the client expectations, because there's a lot of misunderstanding on the part of clients about what public relations is and what it can actually achieve.
I think it pays to let the client know that they have hired you for your experience and your expertise, and that they have to rely on that. If you go in as a client thinking that the PR person is going to be, constantly in the face of reporters, then you're going to be disappointed, because a PR professional is going to know when to pitch and when to wait and, when to hang back. I always tell my clients it's a long-term process. I try to have clients engage in a campaign for a minimum of 6 months, because in a best case scenario, if a reporter does get back to you positively, they may not get to that story for another month or two. And when they do, it may not run for another month or two after that. Also, you have to trust that technology today works. If you sent an email and you don't hear back, chances are they received your email. It's kind of superfluous and I think a little bit annoying to say, hey, did you get my email? However, I'm a big proponent of following up And when I do that, I always try to add some additional nugget of information, some new development or something that wasn't included the first time to help sweeten the pot a little bit. And maybe that's, you know, drawing a comparison to something that's relevant that's going on in the news that wasn't happening when you first sent the pitch. So I think if you can add a little bit of value, there's nothing wrong with following up. However, that said, you don't want to be following up, you know, every week.
So as you look out over the business that you're doing and the clients you're working with, what's your expectation for the PR economy over the next 12 to 18 months?
That's a good question. I find that PR goes up and down. The demand for it goes up and down like a roller coaster. And I think a lot of it has to do with the closing of fiscal years and fiscal budgets and trying to use that money at certain times of the year before losing out on that budget money. But I think that there is a little bit of a shift towards, and it's probably going to increase towards recognizing the value of what we call earned media versus paid advertising. And paid advertising is just very, very expensive, prohibitively expensive for many organizations. And I think they're going to become more aware that they can generate significant messaging through earned media and save a lot of money in the process.
And one of the things that comes up pretty regularly now alongside social media is the idea of content marketing. And that is, you know, preparing content that appears to be editorial copy or stories about a client that are not produced by the mainstream media or by a media outlet. People go back and forth on whether this is valuable, whether it's influential. What's your take on it?
Well, I think there's a place for it. But again, you cannot be overly self-promoting. I kind of wince when I see a lot of, when I see a lot of publications, perhaps, running more and more what they call business spotlights.
It says business spotlight on the top, and it may look and sound like an article, but it was it was paid for.
Mm-hmm. This used to be just sort of reserved to the real estate sections. You know, there would be a lot of paid content in the real estate section, but now it's moving out into other parts of the publications.
Oh yeah, it's all over the publications. I can think of a couple of local magazines that 2/3 of the publication are business spotlights, which is a shame because they used to be a viable place to get your clients, to get my clients featured. Now, even if I can get my client featured, more jaundiced readers might think that it's a paid piece. I think in the best content, you're bringing in competitive information, mentions of other businesses in your field. I always tell my clients that if you're mentioned in an article, it doesn't matter if the article is not all about you. In fact, it's desirable if the reporter talks to some of your competitors in the article. It just makes it that much more credible. And that's where the value of public relations is, in the credibility.
Gary, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Gary Frisch is from Swordfish Communications in Voorhees, New Jersey. He's on the web at swordfishcom.com. And that will wrap things up for this edition of the Lou Betkin on Communications podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. If you have comments or suggestions about these programs, please write to us. My email address is steve@loubetkincommunications.com. Be sure to check out my book, The Business of Podcasting, How to Take Your Podcasting Passion from the Personal to the Professional, co-authored with Donna Papacosta of Toronto. More information at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, a division of the Lou Betkin Media Companies, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at beingthemedia.com. And for all of us at the Lou Betkin Media Companies and Professional Podcasts, this is Steve Lou Betkin. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.